Welcome back to Land of Mankind, a podcast that opens a portal to the realms of Moroccan history, where I take you along with me as we travel through time to uncover the stories of the minds that shaped Morocco. Put your seatbelt on and hold my hand, because we are about to embark on one pretty awesome journey as we follow the footsteps of a visionary leader who shaped the course of the Maghreb region. With some help, I shall say. Ladies and gentlemen, the life and legacy of Abdelmoumen. Let's set the decor here. Morocco, 11th century. Now, I'm not teaching you anything, but the African borders are not quite what we know them to be now. In fact, the very notion of borders has only been set in stone, so to speak, fairly recently when you think about it. And the further you climb down the ladder of history, the more foggy and blurred and moving, especially, they appear. But if we had to set the decor in the world as we know it today, because that's always easier, right? We'd say that Abdelmoumen was born in 1094 in present-day Algeria, in a small tiny village on the slopes of Mount Filosen named Tagra near Nedroma. The city later became a very famous refuge to many Andalusian immigrants that were fleeing the Spanish kings as they were trying to wipe out Muslims from Al-Andalus. Let's go back to Abdelmoumen. His father was a pottery maker, so modest upbringing. The theater of his early years was that of 12th century North Africa. And what a time to be living in those landscapes. The horizon he had to work with, the frame of his childhood, so to speak, was that of a Maghreb region that was trying to balance out ancestral traditions, so Amazigh traditions, and the dawn of Islam, a rather tumultuous blend of tribal rivalries on one hand and religious fervor on the other hand. We can only imagine how much of a fertile ground it must have been for the kind of mind we know him to have grown into. His family were called the Koumia, and they belonged to the Zenata Confederation. Now, if you're familiar at all with the genealogy of the Amazigh tribes, you've probably already come across that name. But worry you shall not, for those of you who are coming across the Zenata for the first time with this podcast, let's pause for a second while we zoom out of Abdelmoumen to focus on the context of his upbringing, because I promise it will make the rest of the story so much clearer once you'll be able to connect the dots. This is one of the most fascinating aspects of digging history. As much as Abdelmoumen and the people I talk about on this podcast are of their own kind and sometimes can seem extraordinary, even metahumans, given the substance, the density of their character and human experience, you quickly realize that there only ever are ordinary men that have to work with extraordinary circumstances. The Zenata, or Iznetin, as you would call them in Tamazight, are a group of Amazigh tribes, a confederation of different smaller Amazigh societies, so to speak, as there were many back in the day. The Zenata are one of the largest confederations that passed the test of time, alongside the Sanhaja and Masmouda. But we'll dive deeper into that tree structure in an upcoming podcast episode, I promise. According to the historian Ibn Khaldun, who conducted a very thorough research on the Zenata were subdivided into three groups. This is where it gets interesting. The majority quickly adopted Islam when it got imported to Western Africa in the 7th century. And that links into Abdelmoumen's upbringing. Sure, from a very young age, he showed extreme intelligence and a strong sense of curiosity. He was said to be very articulate and fairly sharp. But one thing has to be said about his surroundings. His uncle, Ye'lou, saw right through the intellectual substance that was boiling in him. His uncle was that one family figure that believed in the power of pursuing studies and was not about to let his nephew's potential rot in the short walls of their village. So Ye'loum did something pretty extraordinary. He took Abdelmoumen under his wing and took it upon himself to accompany him on his quest for knowledge. A quest that propelled the two men on the roads that lead to the east. Though their expedition did not go beyond the urban center of Bougie, which we now know as Bijaya, in eastern Algeria. And thank God it didn't! Imagine if he'd gone further or simply skipped that stop. He wouldn't have made the encounter that truly, truly marked the beginning of the rest of his life. His meeting with Bentumert. As Plutarch would say, fate leads him who follows it, and drags him who resists. In our case, we'll probably just switch fate with God. Let's open a little bubble in time here. Jump out of our comfy wagon and get on the train right next to us for a sec. Because all while Abdelmoumen and his uncle are traveling through the wide expanse of the East seeking knowledge, somebody's on their way back from their own spiritual and intellectual quest. With a well-filled mind and a pure heart full of enthusiasm, a determination to spread the truth and restore the fundamental values of Islam with the new knowledge he just imported from the capital of Al-Khalifa Al-Umayyah, the Umayyad Caliphate. Bint Umert is on his way back home. Like magnets, the two men, each on their individual journey, were actually bestowed upon each other by an equation greater than themselves. And the city center of Bijaya was about to become the theater of a star collision. Now, since his departure from his native mountain in the High Atlas, Bint Umert, who I'll be dedicating an entire podcast episode on very soon, learned much from the Muslim scholars and thinkers of Baghdad, Al-Qahira, and Dimashq. The idea of sharing with his fellow believers of the West the principles of a renewed Islam he imported from the lavishing libraries and study centers of the East, spreading his newly acquired conception of the truth amongst his people, teaching them the joy and fulfillment he experienced firsthand, devoting to the unity of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, were all prospects that filled his heart with joy and excitement. He was inspired and aspiring to inspire. So when the two men walked into Bijaya, matches made in heaven. On the one hand, Abdul Mumin, accompanied by the human form shadow that is his uncle, is hungry for knowledge. And on the other hand, Bint Umert's intellectual and spiritual stomach, so to speak, is full. There's also something to be said about the symbol that the town of their first encounter, Bijaya, bears. The city was porous and attentive to the teachings that were exported from the East, where all the intellectual emulsion was happening. Bijaya was on the receiving end of all that dynamic, a window into the Islamic Golden Age that sheltered the development of the fine arts and sciences. To give you an example, one of the men who introduced modern mathematics to Europe in the 13th century, Fibonacci, would have allegedly, studied in Bijaya and probably sourced his knowledge in that town. However, the city, which was under the Hamadid Caliphate's rule at the time, didn't treat Bint Umert so well. Remember when I said he was all hopeful and all in all happy to spread the righteous parole around? Well, that never faded away really. But the least we can say is that when his efforts to quote-unquote talk sense into his pairs would die in frustration due to a lack of reciprocity, he wouldn't hold back expressing his anger. When he would find his words meeting dead ends after dead ends because some people, particularly some local elites, weren't willing to listen or align with his ideas, Bint Umert would kind of throw a couple temper tantrums here and there. You know, going around breaking wine jars so the people of Bijaya had no choice but to cut out alcohol of their diet, smashing instruments on the ground so music wouldn't take up the space he believed faith should have allocated in their minds, and so forth. For the local authorities, he was a madman trying to create a cult. This hostility turned into a literal cancel culture of Bint Umert, with the prospect of getting him expelled from the city. At one point, he was compelled to oblige, seeking refuge in the suburb of Mlala nearby, where he decided to continue his mission of spreading the good parole in a mosque. It was actually there, in 1117, that he met the young Abdul Mumin, who quickly developed an admiration for his new mentor. As he heard the tales of Bint Umert's journey from the East, the young man simply could not believe a literal mountain of knowledge had been brought all the way to him. And from that day on, Abdul Mumin was clear on what his purpose had to be. Whatever mission Bint Umert was going to hop on, he was going to be all in with him, for the most part because he was sold on his mentor's vision. Speaking of a mentor, it was only natural that Bint Umert was going to have his newly found disciple assist him during his regular street incidents his unwillingness to budge on his ideas would provoke. The least we can say is that Bint Umert would practice what he'd preach, fully embodying his doctrine. He didn't just talk the talk, he would walk the walk and step all over the sins that covered the road. Now, I wouldn't want any of you to think of Bint Umert as an uncontrollable, unreasonable man. After all, his knowledge of the Islamic sciences wouldn't let him turn into that. As a scholar who had been dedicating years to studying classical texts, mastering Arabic, and engaging with contemporary issues, he had tremendous intellectual and spiritual depth, a commitment to education, investing his time in teaching and mentoring students, nurturing the next generations of scholars. During the early days of Ibn Tumert's movement, Abd al-Mumin didn't initially stand out among his disciples. He was actually a pretty ordinary man. As Ibn Tumert had rallied a group of followers and as they were journeying to Marrakesh, Abd al-Mumin was fully content with his role of being a mere yes-man and a student. However, one day, everything changed. Let's set the decor. At first, Ibn Tumert's mission was strictly religious. Then it became political. And that's when the stars shifted. He officially and boldly declared his opposition to the ruling dynasty Ibn Abitun, the Almoravid regime, if you prefer, claiming himself to be Mahdi, the divinely guided one. In Islam, the arrival of al-Mahdi is supposed to be a sign of the end of time, signaling how close we would be to the apocalypse. The figure of al-Mahdi is held in high regards in the eyes of Muslims. So for someone that wants to overpower a ruling dynasty by not only winning battles, but also earning the trust of the people, the population, that's actually a pretty strategic and smart move, if you ask me. And as soon as Ibn Tumert declared war, essentially, to the central power, he became a national number one enemy, turning into the prey of the central regime, subject to a hunt all over the territory. In a decisive moment, when Ibn Tumert sought refuge in the remote reaches of the High Atlas Mountains, Abd al-Mumin faithfully decided to go with him. I'm telling you, this guy's been saying he was gonna follow him. In the sanctuary of the mountains, Ibn Tumert began to attract more and more followers. He then established a nascent Almohad state, self-proclaimed, in complete opposition with the central power. A bold, arbitrary move, but man oh man, was it a clever one. Because by that point, he had enough people around him, enough resources to go to war. He decided to center the headquarters of the movement, so to speak, around the modest village of Tinmel. That's the thing, they were compelled to hide still, because it was pretty controversial still back in the day to say you were part of Ibn Tumert's movement. In the beginning stages of the movement, him and his followers would live this life of outlaws, planning and scheming for the takeover of the regime, rather undisturbed. Abd al-Mumin, like I said, wasn't exactly standing out, but he was rather observing, learning, and obeying the commands. But a tragedy written in the stars changed that entire dynamic. Ibn Tumert lost his trusted second-in-command and reformer, al-Bashir, as he fell in an attack on Marrakesh, where the ruling dynasty was established. In the wake of this loss, Abd al-Mumin stepped into the void, assuming Bashir's position and becoming Ibn Tumert's chosen successor. Right then and there, Ibn Tumert really saw something special in his disciple. He didn't waste any time in giving him a big role among the top leaders of the Almohad movement that just started, like I said, in Tinmel. Small function that would then allow him to climb the ladder later, so to speak. No. Shortcut, straight to, my guy, you're the replacement. Ibn Tumert even brought Abd al-Mumin into his own tribe, the Harga, adopting him, where he'd be part of the infamous Council of Ten. The air of Tinmel grows thick with anticipation as Ibn Tumert, poised to ascend the highest seat of power, stands at the center of attention, surrounded by his council of 10 trusted advisors, among which Abd al-Mumin. Each advisor is a beacon of wisdom and experience in his own right, and brings forward his counsel. They speak of strategy, of alliances forged and broken, of the delicate balance between power and justice. While Ibn Tumert listens, his gaze unwavering, his mind as sharp as a sword, he knows that the decisions that were made within these headquarters will shape the fate of a nation, determining the path it will tread in the turbulent waters of history. With the council's blessing and the trust of the people, a small community that started forming around him, al-Muwahidin stand poised, ready to write a new chapter, bound by their shared journey from religious fervor to political prominence. Abd al-Mumin really started shining as the master's top promoter, so to speak. He would always join in on military missions and prove himself as a fierce warrior. However, when Ibn Tumert passed away in 1130, things got a bit complicated. Abd al-Mumin wasn't automatically recognized as the new leader. His rise to power was more of a roller coaster than it was anything else. And ladies and gentlemen, it is time for me to introduce the third member of the Almohad trifecta. Sheikh Abu Hafs Omar al-Hintati. Sheikh Abu Hafs Omar al-Hintati, also known as Feska Zdelinti in the Amazigh dialect, comes to us directly from the Hintata tribe in the Moroccan High Atlas. Remember the Amazigh family tree I told you about? Well, our guy comes from the Masmouda, so still one of the three largest confederations. Abu Hafs was part of the Council of Ten, the big league of the Almohad movement, I hope you're following. It was founded by Bin Sumert that would prepare the operations to take over Morabiton, etc. Though some historians raise their eyebrows about his exact role in that council. They say his shining moment actually came later during a showdown in Wahran when he clinched victory against the last Almoravid emir. All we can say for sure is that he was one of Bin Sumert's most trusted companions, because that was the condition required to be part of the Council of Ten. Now let me build up the story a little bit. Here's where it gets interesting. Abu Hafs ties the knot with one of Abdul Mumin's daughters. They have a son, Muhammad. While Abdul Mumin's busy running the show, Abu Hafs takes charge of the military operations. He's the go-to guy for all the tough missions and game-changing campaigns. So much to say about him, so we will leave his story for another podcast episode. Are you still with me? Yes? Now let's pop the bubble, back to topic. Abu Hafs' most significant feat was actually him securing the throne for Abdul Mumin, which is why I'm telling you about him. He played a pivotal role ensuring that Abdul Mumin rose to power. So upon the death of the Almohad master Bin Sumert, it actually took a lot of convincing from Abu Hafs Omar al-Hintati for him to finally be accepted as successor. See, what they did yet is they kept Bin Sumert's death a secret until the Council of Ten could agree on the new leader. And the least we can say is that it was a bit tense, with some folks of the council being a bit shaky, not really sure about whether they should or should not be accepting Abdul Mumin, an outsider from the central Maghrib, a newcomer to the High Atlas region. They wanted someone local. They wanted a Masmoudian from blood. And one thing that I find interesting is Abu Hafs Omar al-Hintati's loyalty towards Abdul Mumin, which could be partially explained by the fact that he married into Abdul Mumin's family. But when you know that even after Abdul Mumin's time was up, when he was in the grave, Abu Hafs, who was still living, remained steadfast, backing Abdul Mumin's son for succession, Muhammad, even though fate had other plans and Abu Yaqub Yusuf finally ended up ascending the throne, yet Abu Hafs stood by his side, loyal till the end, just like he was to his father, Abdul Mumin. So like I said, everyone's a bit shaky, everyone's a bit worried, despite Bin Sumert having been clear on his instructions that he wanted Abdul Mumin to succeed and replace him. They simply didn't want to listen. So Abdul Mumin had to prove himself. Imagine how you spend years of your life being convinced that you're gonna ascend. The master himself puts you at the top of the hierarchy for everyone to see that you're the favorite, for everyone to know. And when the master can no longer look, the mosques fall apart, revealing a bunch of hungry wolves. But eventually, after a victorious mission that was led by Abdul Mumin against the Gazula tribe, they finally declared him as the new leader. And that, my friend, marked a turning point for their movement. In fact, before that, they were mostly confined to local areas, with even their attempt to reach Marrakesh ending in a failure. But upon Abdul Mumin's proclamation as the leader of Al-Muwahidun, he ascended to the esteemed position of Caliph, signaling a new era for the movement.